Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. Welcome, my friends, to another episode of Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Today, we are going to take you on a little bit of a safari, and we're going to be discussing today the elusive zebu and buffalo and other kinds of wonderful, marvelous animals that I had to put into the Google search engine to figure out what they are. And joining us today to discuss this is Rabbi Binyamin Fishman, and we're going to be discussing not just these really fascinating, marvelous animals, but what their kashrus status means for the broader question about how we establish normative halachic practice. Rabbi Fishman is a Rebbe at Yeshivas Derech and Or Sameach, and is a highly regarded lecturer in halacha and hashkafa. He is a graduate of Or LaGola and of Kolel Toras Chaim, and is a certified Mashgiach Kashrus by the Rabbanut of Israel and by Rav Mordechai Kuber. In addition, he is an associate director of the Chol B'nayich Community Programs based in Tel Tzion, Israel. He's involved in numerous programs aimed at promoting a balanced Torah lifestyle for individuals and for communities. Now, to find out more about his projects or for more information about speaking arrangements, he can be contacted on his email, which we will make sure to include in the show notes. Make sure to go there to find the email address, bfishmanderech@gmail.com. Okay, I read it out. There you go. Okay, so Rabbi Fishman, Hello. It's a pleasure to have you with us all the way from Eretz Yisrael, and you picked what is a very exciting topic. As I said, I had to go on Google and figure out what a zebu is before we could even discuss it. So if you could first tell our audience, who is likewise like me and doesn't know these things, what is a zebu? And I think we're going to be looking at a tshuva of the Chazon Ish, and also Rabbi Yisrael Belsky making a debut on the podcast. I didn't realize Rabelsky actually had formal Shaos and Shuvos that were published. I certainly knew he was a posek, but I didn't know he had his own Shaos and Shuvos. So maybe you could tell us first what a zebu is, a little bit about the Chazon Ish and Rabelsky, and then what is the topic that we are really sinking our teeth into today? No pun intended.
Well, it's a very meaty subject, but we'll...
Hopefully.
Great to be here. Great to finally see you in person. As close as Zoom can be in person. So first off, a zebu is a kind of cow. It's a regular cow. It's native to South Asia. It on the specific, unique part of the cow. I don't know, is it possible to put the picture on the screen of it?
I can't, but you know what? Anyone who puts zebu into their search engine, unless you're able to share. Most people are listening over audio, but you got to imagine like a camel. It's like a camel hump on it, right?
It has a big camel. It's a cow that has a camel hump right above its neck, and it also has very loose skin right around its neck hanging down. If you picture like a turkey's wattle almost, so it has a lot of loose skin hanging down, and it has that hump. Now, specifically, what makes the zebu an interesting kind of cow, we'll get to more of the details of it, but it works very well in hot or not quite desert, but more arid countries. We're used to thinking of like American cows, which are made, they're using green pastures in America with lots of land, or the Angus or even the Wagyu in Japan. This kind of cow is much better for more arid type places, which means it's much more sturdy, much more able to be transported a bit. And we'll see that was very important. The question of zebu came up, again, just a drop of that history, when the state of Israel was founded in 1948, and had all these Jews coming back, there's a big question of where to get meat from. And Israel couldn't really have meat from, you didn't really have cows. Cows don't really live in Israel that well to have be able to supply all these new people coming. But they found there's a lot of zebu, some in Israel, and also they were able to shecht in South America and overseas. The zebu was able, as I think also in North Africa, it was much more accessible. They weren't going to start shipping from North America, but they could ship meat. They could have people go to North Africa or even south certain places. So the Zebo was able to live in those places. The question actually came up in the 19th, Rav Yitzchak Herzog, the chief rabbi, was asked from a community in France, actually, but connected to Israel. He asked where, they were asked about whether this is kosher. And Herzog held, it was very clearly kosher. But even though he was the chief rabbi, and he could have definitely have said it's kosher, and he had a long 20-page tshuva that's kosher, he felt he wanted to make sure to get the scum of the agreement of the Chaz Nish, of Avi Mishaya Karelitz, who was the leading, he was considered the leading authority in Israel from 1933 when he came to Israel until he passed away in 1952-53. He was the authoritative figure in Israel, the undisputed posek, the leader of the Orthodox community, during all the battles of the founding of the state and the nature of the state. He was the, when he said something, it went.
So if he gives you a green light, kal vachomer, everyone else is pretty much going to give you a green light.
Exactly. Nobody's going to argue at that point. So that's why he wanted the Chazon Ish to give him a green light. And to his chagrin, the Chazon Ish didn't. Chazon Ish gave him a red light, which we're going to talk about.
I'm not super surprised about that, but what was the reasoning behind that?
So I just want to talk a drop about Lubelsky, then we'll go into the reasoning. He was coming from the Lashon of the Poskim. So we'll take this topic through because there's a parallel topic besides Zebu, which is the American bison. In America, it's very common they want to be able to shech the bison. They've actually crossbred bison and American cow. I think they call it the beefalo. I think they call it because it's a lower fat content meat. The thing about the American bison, which is also, it's not really a typical kind of cow. It's a cow, but it's not the typical Angus. Typical, when you go to the farm, you don't usually see bison. They roam wild. I'm going to learn that's the big question. You have a wild or new type of species. Can we assume it's automatically kosher? And the big postic in America dealt with this is Rebelsky, who was very emphatic that it is kosher. So just a drop out Rebelsky. There might be bigger postkin than Rebelsky, but Rebelsky definitely is unique in that not only was he a postic in all of Shulchan Aruch, all of Torah, he has tshuvas in Kachim, he has everything, but he also is singular in his knowledge of scientific information.
Oh, wow.
Just a couple of examples. He would go out to Camp Aguda in the summertime. One time they noticed he was walking with the Talmidim at nighttime and looked up and said, hey, that star is not supposed to be there. And next day he called NASA and it turned out that there was some star that comes like every 50 years. It's not a headless comet. There's a star that appears. And that was the night, it was the first night that it appeared in over 50 years.
Wow.
If you look in the art school Gemaras, all the astronomy, all of the scientific information, even though he never went to college, but he felt he has to know the reality of things in order to rule. One of the, just real quick, this just blows you away. He was the leading postdoc for the OU, along with Baruch Haim Rav Herschel Schechter, Rav Schechter and Rebelsky, the two postkim. He's with Rabbi Shochet and Moro. So one time he went to a factory to supervise the meat production. Now, after the shechita, he had to cut the meat and this. And he saw that the non-Jewish workers weren't listening to the mashgichim. I was like, well, what do these rabbis need? No. So he called them all over. He went over to a carcass of a cow that had been cut up and dissected. And he reassembled the cow, putting all the meats, all the cuts of meat back together like a puzzle to reassemble the cow. In order to show the workers that the rabbis know how meat's supposed to go and what to do.
Can't pull a fast one on us.
Exactly.
Makes sense that Rebelsky, as you mentioned, was one of the main poskim for the OU. And so even though, of course, he had a mastery of Kol HaTorah Kula, kashrus was something that he frequently was asked to paskin on. And so it makes sense that this kind of comes to his desk to paskin on the nature of bison and zebu and other species that are ambiguous.
Exactly. He's one of the leading authorities worldwide on kashrus. And we're looking at Shadrach and Tshuvas. A good fit of the child is all about kashrus, including the standards. He set a lot of the standards that other organizations use besides the OU. And he also has hundreds of unpublished tshuvas that are published internally on the OU from a shkichim. So this is where the background.
Yeah, this is important because many times, you know, you look up, you have a quick technical kosher's question about a certain kind of material. Can it be koshered? You Google it, an OU article comes up. It cites Rev Belsky, but here we're actually looking at the primary source, his actual writings. So he, you said, right, the Chazon Ish gave a more machmir psak. He took a prohibitive stance, which I think you'll unpack for us in just a moment. And then Rebelsky is the one who's going to push back on the machmir position of the Chazon Ish, right?
Correct. And just to be fair, at the time, the big person who pushed back was of Herzog, as I mentioned, the chief rabbi. But I'm using Rebelsky. They have a similar line. Rebelsky is a bit more concise, and he adds some extra punch, if you will, that's very relevant and very much more relevant for us. He adds some nuances that's very important for us.
I make sure to read the Shas Tshuvas ahead of time. I'm very excited. if you don't cite certain lines, I'm going to make sure to do them because they are very punchy. But I think also from a social standpoint, Rav Herzog was in a little bit of a different community than the Chazon Ish. Rav Belsky, my understanding, is very entrenched within the Olam HaYeshivos. So this is coming internal. This is internal disagreement.
Exactly.
So it's more likely to be accepted when it comes from someone like Rav Belsky. And I guess we'll talk about toward the end of the episode what actually happened in Yende, who became accepted. So I'm looking forward to learning about that. But first, let's understand what their machlokis is all about.
Okay, so let's unpack. So there's something unique with kashrus of animals. We're used to thinking of kashrus as very binary, right? You have fish. You have fish, right? Fish, if they have fins and scales, they're kosher. If they don't have fins and scales, they're not kosher. Taking it, what kind of scales and this, but if the kosher is not kosher, you have birds. The Torah lists 24 types of birds. If you know which are not kosher, if you know that a bird is one of those 24, it's not kosher. If not, it's kosher. It's either kosher or it's not kosher. Very binary. When it comes to animals, we have a very unique case here, right? So we all know animals have to have split hooves and they have to chew their cud, right? The two signs of a kosher animal. But there's really two types of kosher animal. There's what's called behema, and there's what's called a chaya. Behema, we would translate as domesticated animals, and chaya are wild animals. So the classic example of a chaya would be, say, a deer, and the classic example of behemos would be, say, cow and sheep and goats. Mm-hmm. Right? The Torah lists, there are three types of behemos, domesticated animals that are kosher, cow, sheep, and goat. And there are seven types that are not, that are chayas. Again, they're kosher, but they're chayas. Now, what's the difference between a behema and a chaya? And an animal, all other names taste just as good. But it's not true, because there are certain differences, not getting to all the details of it. The main two differences that are relevant is that we know that when you have an animal, let's say you have a cow, if you start shechting it, you have to devein, get rid of the veins, get rid of some of the sciatic nerve, and you have to get rid of some fats. There are a lot of fats of the animal that are prohibited. It's called chaylev, and the chaylev of an animal, of a cow, is prohibited. The Torah says chaylev is one of the things that goes up when they offer it as a sacrifice, a korban. It goes up in the mizbeach, and therefore, since it's part of that, you can't eat it. Whereas chaya is not used as a korban, and the fat of a deer, let's say, is not prohibited. So very simply, if you shech a cow, you're going to have to get rid of a lot of fat. That's the fat that's on the kidneys, all the other places. Very hard and laborious to do. And if you shech the deer, you don't have to take care of it. So that's a major, major difference. Okay? Now, the problem is that there are seven types of kosher wild animals, chayot, that are mentioned. And there are three types of kosher behemot. But again, there's a lot of gray area, right? So for instance, let's say you talk about a cow. So we know a cow is a cow, right? But what about a yak? What about a bison? What about a water buffalo? You know, one of the wild animals called a tao was some sort of wild ox. That means if you have an ox, if you have a wild ox, is this the kind of ox that's going to be prohibited or it's going to be permissible? There's confusion in identifying what is what. So the Gemara says, how are we going to figure it out? We're going to give you signs of the horns. And the Gemara gives a whole list if the horns are this kind of horn, if it's flat, if it's curvy, if it's all kinds of nuance. So that's how you can determine whether it's a behemoth or a chai, whether it's a domesticated animal or non-domesticated animal. This is through the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch. The problem comes in, the Shach, there's one of the comments, so the Shulchan Aruch was written in roughly the early 1500s. Okay? It codifies all of this. Just to speak outside, there it says, a behemoth, a kosher animal has split hooves and chooses cud. That's in Simon Ayin Tes, 79. You're there, 79. That's in general. Now, what's a chayah? That's chapter 80, Simon 80. And it says, it starts describing the horns. Comes along the Shach, the Sifsei Cohen, written by Shabsi Cohen, and he's writing in the early 1600s. And he says, if you want a description of all of the way the horns look, look in the Beis Yosef. He wrote it there. I'm not going to tell you about it because animals are not. Oh, if eno ne'echal, it is not eaten without a tradition. You have to have a tradition in order to eat it, and therefore I'm not going to bother getting into the details of this. What kind of horns are yes? What kind of horns not?
Right. His language is, it's very short. He says, Lafisha ain lanu ata ela masha kibala b'mesora. Since all we have is basically whatever we have a tradition for, as we mentioned in Simon Pei Beis, gabe simani ha'of. So therefore, katsarti. Not much for me to talk about because we just, seemingly what he's saying is, we just, whatever we have a mesora for, whatever has been passed on to us through tradition is good. And we cannot start introducing new kinds of species or animals. And I guess the big question here is whether these different kinds of zebus and buffaloes and bison and what have you, are they a new animal or maybe they're just a kind of cow? And we're not actually introducing anything new, which I think is something Rebelski himself mentions.
Right. And there's even a slightly bigger problem over here. Because he says we don't eat. So there's two ways of understanding that sentence. I want to set up the two ways of understanding it. And we'll see, because that will lead into the Machlokas Chaznish. And Rebelski is really trying to pick up on this point. You could say it means we don't eat animals unless we have a Masorah. That means if we don't have a Masorah, we won't cheat the animals being kosher.
Mm.
So what does that mean? So again, we have cow, sheep, goat that are domesticated. And then we have, let's say, deer, right? Deer, is worth mentioning, by the way, a side point, but it's very important that the post can mention it. Deer, everybody understands deer is kosher. Why? Because deer horns are very different than cow horns. Mm-hmm. Now, if you don't call them horns, we call them antlers. They're made of different, they have blood, they fall off, they go up. So the deer family, everyone knows is kosher, right? Deer, moose, elk, reindeer, caribou. But besides that, if you don't have a masorah, you can't eat it at all. That's why we're reading it. Now, this is very problematic. This is a very difficult way to understand it. Because if he's saying this, where is he getting it from? Where did this come up? What does it mean that we have to have a masorah? The Shulchan Aruch was written 100 years earlier. The Shulchan Aruch didn't say this. More than that.
What about the Ramah vis-a-vis poultry?
Oh, very, very good. So this is an interesting point, because in the Ramah, and the Ramah was writing in the midpoint around the 1500s, 100 years earlier, give or take. So poultry is explicit in the Torah. There's 24 species that are not kosher. And then the Gemara gives you signs, because that's 24 species, species and subspecies. The Gemara gives you signs, what, you know, how the feet look and how the digestion is. And all of the Rishonim already say, we don't want to rely on the signs. There are cases that are mentioned of mistakes. You have to have a tradition. And the Ramah comes along and he says, you have to have a tradition. That's very good. That means when you look at the halakhic process, there's what the Torah says, there's a lack of certainty which gets introduced in the Rishonim, in the Gemara Rishonim's time. And based on that, we have a halakhic consensus. We can't rely on the names of the birds the Torah gives. You have to have tradition. That follows the very normal halakhic process. Mm. Whereas over here, the Torah says, if it chews its cud and it has split hooves, it's kosher.
Ah.
It doesn't tell you the difference between a chayah and a behemah. The Gemara lists what those are. None of the Rishonim are bothered by this. They're all trying to discuss what kind of horns this, but at the very least, and the Ramah over by us didn't say you have to be stringent. On the contrary, to have a van split hose, if it chooses to cut, it's kosher. And the next sif after this in Shulchan Aruch, it says, what do you do if you don't know if it's a behema or a chaya? You have to be stringent. What's stringent mean? You don't eat the chalib, and another mitzvah of kis, you have to do kis without covering the blood, which is a separate thing. That means, in the Shulchan Aruch, it says, if you want to know if it's a chaya, look at its horns. If you're not sure, be stringent and don't eat the chalib, but the animal itself is kosher.
Right, so there's no question about the actual kosher status inherently of the animal. The question is just about the chalev itself. So really, we have a lot more latitude over here as long as we're applying the criteria that the Torah gives us.
Exactly, so, and the Ramah himself, the Ramah who's stringent by birds, is not stringent here. So if the Shach is coming to say, we have to be stringent here like we are by birds, this is very difficult to understand where it comes from, where does this pop up, and bigger, why should this be? Whereas the other reading it is, you can't eat an animal as being definitely a chaya, definitely a wild animal, meaning to permit the fats, the chaliv, that you can't do without a tradition. And this fits very nicely. Because what does it mean? Sif Aleph, we're saying, in order to eat this as an animal, you have to know what the horns are. Sif Bet is, if you don't know, you have to be stringent. But the Shach is saying is, we don't rely on the horns, mm-hmm. and therefore, if you're not sure, you have to be stringent. And do what? Eat it as a suffix. Like we said by the birds, this now fits very nicely by the birds. Why does this fit nicely by the birds? Because by the birds, we know certain types of kosher, or not kosher, let's say, and we say we don't want to rely on the names of it. Here we have, there are certain animals that are chaya. We don't want to rely on the signs that are given. But it's a very small, limited question. We're not changing this whole idea of what is called a kosher animal. No. Of course it's kosher. It's split hooves. There's no reason to be strict about the split, about is it kosher at all. Of course it's kosher. It's split hooves and chooses cut. So it's a much smaller, and where did it come from? So this is an important point. A lot of the halakha is, so to speak, theoretical. What do you mean theoretical? There wasn't much migration back in the day. If you were in Poland, you had the cows, you had the wild animals that you had. I mean, you had a tradition. You knew what the deer were. If there were other wild animals, you knew what they were. If you're in the Middle East, you have, let's say, gazelle, antelope, let's say, you know what those animals are. That means this isn't such a relevant question. So Shach is saying, over the past 100 years, we're not going to be lenient to eat the fat of an animal. That's just kind of what happened. Meaning, it just came up this way. Mm-hmm. Now, so who says this? So this is really a machloket in the 1700s, in the two approaches understanding the Shach. We have the Prima Gadim, is written by Rav Yosef Teumim. He wrote a commentary on the Shach, and he explicitly says, but the Shach says, we don't eat it. It means we don't eat it, the fat of it. But of course, eat it. Why shouldn't we eat it? Of course, we can eat it. We don't eat the fat. The Chochmas Adam, written by Avraham Danziger, also in the mid-1700s, he has a much more concise language. We don't eat any animals without a Masorah. And it's enough. He has language of...
Period. That's it. We don't eat if period. We don't have a Masorah. Okay. Right.
And he mentions the deers being the example. Again, deer is very good because deer, the antlers intrinsically are different. Okay. So now we come along. And if both of them were in Lithuania... one difference, by the way, one difficult problem is geography is constantly changing. But if you know the European history of the... Mm. So that means if you're in Lithuania one day, you could be in Poland the next day. And you
right, the borders are constantly shifting with every conflict.
Right, so. But they're more or less the same geographic area. Now we shift to 1900s. So 1900s already, we have migration. We have mass migration. People are leaving Europe, they're going to South America and South Africa, and they're going to North America. They're traveling all over. We have people going to Australia now. You have mass migration, which is a new phenomenon. So now we're having these questions come up. So we're talking about 150 to 200 years after the Prima Gaudium and the Shach wrote what they wrote their works. Now we're trying to figure out, so what's the law? Can you eat the animal, like the Prima Gaudium, just don't eat the fats, or you can't eat the animal at all, like the Chochmas Adam. Now we're trying to figure out what was the law back then. We're used to having like Piskei Halacha, a safer like Mishnah Berurah that says we do X, but they didn't have that. They had two Sfarim that were widely
We need some like detective work over here. We need some way to investigate this, but we don't seem to have a lot of evidence. We're only working off the testimony of Poskim who lived within their own limited area. So this brings us really to the Chazon Ish, to his contention.
So because now we have the Zigu. We have Rav Herzog asking the Chazon Ish, is it kosher? And the Chazon Ish says that Halacha is like the Chochmas Adam, and he has really three points that are very salient. Point number one, he says, he happens that he thinks Pshat in the Shach, the simple reading of the Shach is like the Chochmas Adam. He says the Chochmas Adam was the accepted posek. That means that's the safer we use. We use the Chochmas Adam. So if you have a doubt, who do you turn to for the final resolution? The Chochmas Adam. That's the way he says it. And he gives a little bit of an explanation. He says, where did the Shach get this? So the Shach lived with many other Gedolim, and he has to say that they're based in, came along and made a Tekonon, made it an act not to eat it. Meaning the Shach, the Chazon Ish is kind of developing a backstory, if you will.
Right, the Chazon Ish seems to be positing that the Minhag of Lithuania, whatever Lithuania was at the time, as you mentioned with that little caveat there, followed the Chochmas Adam. Yet, I think what we're going to see is Rav Belsky, you know, I think our session already is past the halfway point, but Rav Belsky basically, just to get to his tshuva, he seems to contend with that. Who's to say the Minhag of Lithuania necessarily followed the Chochmas Adam, and the Chochmas Adam seemingly siding with that reading of the Shach based on what the Chazon Ish is contending. I really love what Rav Belsky said is he says Shemati mipi kacho shal agon hadir maran Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky zecher tzadkos shebracha, that I heard from Yaakov Kamenetsky that Shiterim kiblu karav. Yeah, I'm going to butcher this. He says some small city in Lita. Bachnu al kol shura b'sefer pre megadim chelik aleph ubar shabachol eretz lita no kuki different pre megadim. He says, like, I have an opposite proof. Actually, not only did they not seem to follow the shach here and the chachmas adam, but it seemed that they tested their new rabbis on did they know pre megadim well enough, because that was the minhag hamakom. So, right. And minhag hamakom should follow then the prima gadim, who is the matir in this case. So, where's the Chazon Ish coming from saying that that's the minhag of Lithuania that we are beholden to now to the Chochmas Adam, when clearly there are reports in the opposite direction saying we follow prima gadim? And then I guess it leaves you and I to think about, well, I hear reports in both directions. What do I do with this information? What is the minhag? Is there an established minhag?
So, and this is very interesting on two points. One is, who do we take on the Chochmas Adam Prima Gadim? It really is a machlokas even nowadays. In Eretz Yisrael, where the Chazon Ish was here, they follow the Chochmas Adam. That is what they established, the Chochmas Adam. In America, you actually do have a lot more of the Prima Gadim. Meaning, when you have a machlokas Chochmas Adam Prima Gadim, you have the Prima Gadim taking more weight. And the many posts will say it's equal machlokas. It's something like a shakal, they call it. It's equal machlokas here. But one other point which Rav Belsky makes is fascinating, which is, let's say the Lachas like the Chochmas Adam. Let's say he was correct that there was such a minhag on this. But we don't find anybody quoting it and ruling like this for 200 years. I mean, the Chochmas Adam was written in the 1700s. So even if the Chochmas Adam really held what he held, and he said there's such a minhag, but if the minhag isn't being done, we don't find any Rabbanim taking it on, explaining like it. In fact, to the contrary, there are some Rabbanim, we don't have time to go into all the names, but Kaf Chaim and other Rabbanim, who assume the Chochmas Adam learned like the Prima Gadim. Meaning, there are even some who say that the Chochmas Adam Prima Gadim said that we don't eat animals nowadays. They put them all together. So for sure, you don't have a practice of being strict. So if you don't have a practice of being strict, people aren't accustomed. Even if the halacha should be the chokhmah sadam, who says we have to be strict now of these met? That's right. A major, major difference.
And this is important because, you know, Rav Belsky seems to not just simply say that, you know, I could see this way, I could see that way, it's shakal. He seems to come down pretty ardently against the Chazanish to the extent that actually at the end of the first iteration of the tshuva, I underline this, he says, he quotes the Shulchan Aruch, which talks about a rabbi who makes such a flagrantly wrong psak at a din Torah, owes compensation to the party that he charged. And then he extrapolates and says, Ritzon Olomar, Demisha Asar Le'echad Basmin She'ein Alev Mesorah, that if a rabbi goes ahead and says that this piece of meat that you bought is Asar and you cannot eat it because it doesn't have a Mesorah, and now this guy incurs a monetary loss because he had to throw out that piece of, quote, non-kosher meat. He says the rabbi actually owes restitution. Now he has to pay tashlumen. So like Rebelsky feels very strongly about this, that right. He's willing to go into the Dine Choshe Mishpat over here.
Right. He's very, very, very convinced that Ikrib Sak is one small point. Rebelsky creates a different tshuva. I didn't get a chance to send this to you. But just a very important point also, this is a very fundamental concept. I want to mention it. It's very, very fundamental. Then we'll come to the conclusion.
Yeah, we have about 4 minutes left. So let's get the Iker idea. Yeah. Like, what's the main takeaway from this machlokas? And also, if you could slip right in, what actually was the maskana lemaisa? What do people do?
So the last point, which we're summing up, one thing which Rebelsky mentioned, that it was, even if we take on in Europe to do something, this is an important point, in America, where you have mass population, mass shechita, we have to do things sometimes small, meaning the fact that a shochet in a village, when he had one cow, could be strict. When you deal with hundreds of cows, that's normally strict. But that's a general meaning. The fact that we had something that used to be in Europe, nowadays things are different. Rebelsky came out very strong. It's kosher. It's for sure kosher. What's interesting, even in Eretz Yisrael, this is fascinating. In Eretz Yisrael, so the Rav Yashiv, it came out in 2004. It was revealed that 90% of the meat was from Zebu or Zebu offspring.
Oh, wow.
And all of a sudden, everyone's like, what do we do? And that's just, by the way, we can't get into this, but it's not just the meat. Some of the tefillin were made on the parchment. You're talking about Sifrei Torah that have the Gidin. The sinews, you're talking massive, massive upheaval.
Right. What you define as a cow has implications beyond Hilchos Kashrus. I didn't even think about that. Wow.
So the ruling from Rabbi Yashiv and Rav Vosner and Mr. Corellis made a based in. And what they ruled is we're machmir if not to eat the sibu itself, because Chaznish said it. However, we don't have to be worried about the offspring. There's other reasons we can't get into this. So therefore, since it's only it has DNA of a zebu, not an actual zebu. It's a zebu's third or fourth or fifth generation child is what's really lenient. And
it's no St. Tom Bar, no St. Tom at this point.
Right. This question of Chodesh Era, which again, we can't get into all the details there. And Rav Zura Orbach Shlita, who's the son of Rav Yashiv, he wrote, the Iker Psak is not like the Chaznish. However, on the zebu out of covered the Chaznish, on that he paskined, therefore that'd be stringent. But everything else, We don't have to take that on.
So that's fascinating. Like, we don't accept, like, we say in principle that we don't agree with the Chazanish's assessment, but as you mentioned, because he's like the Mara D'Asra, he basically, out of deference to the Chazanish, we're going to respect his psak in this very narrow, localized area, not going Lefnim Meshur Sadin from anything that he actually said. Fascinating.
And that's why you can't get, for Maisa, you won't get bison meat that's kosher, the Mahadran in Israel, but all the postmen in Israel agree it's kosher.
Wow.
They won't do it, but everyone agrees it's kosher. The Rebelsky and the Iker Lakha, everyone agrees with that.
This is remarkable. Right, Fishman, this is such a fascinating sugya. Like, number one, I didn't know what a zebu was until you sent me this material. So number one, I walk away knowing what a zebu is. Number two, I walk away knowing that Rebelsky published his own actual Shalos and Shuvos, which I feel terrible for not knowing beforehand. But I think, were pointing out, in addition to this just being this isn't just simply a kashrus question, this is a more fundamental question in understanding the halachic process, in understanding how do we figure out minhag, how do we figure out normative practice? What if we are convinced of one way? Do we give deference to the other side? Of course, there's only so much we can cover within 30 minutes. Inkam makom laharech. Rabbi Fisher, I want to thank you so much for taking us on this little bit of a safari today, for opening up us to this little debate, which is actually a huge debate within Kashrus. And it should really give us an appreciation for how normative halachic practice has developed and how we eat our food today. Thank you. All right, Kol Tov, and continue Hatzlacha and being Marbitz Torah and Yeshiva and throughout all of your adventures.
Amen. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good seeing you.
Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? Please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.